This is the October 17th, 2014 edition of WFAE Talks. This week, we'll talk about former Mayor Patrick Cannon and his federal prison sentence. We'll discuss the profits that can be made in running charter schools, plus a decision regarding control of Charlotte's airport. Joining me now, as usual, is Ben Bradford, our energy, environment, slash coal ash reporter, airport reporter.
And
city economic development reporter.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Hodgepodge of issues.
You know, I could also say general assignment.
Yes. Yeah, actually, everything. We actually got a complaint. I forgot to tell you this. We got a complaint that we weren't covering coal ash.
No, really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Which
that's got to be the first.
I was shocked.
It's got to be the first.
Obviously disagree with that. We've covered it. Our concern is we've covered it too much at times.
Well, we've certainly done less on it since the law passed and the executive order after the General Assembly wrapped, mm-hmm. after that whole legal fight was kind of the whole kind of legislative fight was, I think, the kind of the last part of it that we've done really in-depth coverage of. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do more coming up. There's a whole bunch of deadlines coming up that we're going to find out all this information, mm-hmm. From Duke about what the plans are for closing these sites and, you know, how that's going to work and get a real view of that going forward. There have been some incremental things before then that, you know, you've seen in some of the papers and things like that, and just haven't felt like, you know, it gives us enough of a big picture of what's going on that it was worth.
Well, we've discussed it and I've concurred in that, and that was our editorial decision. Yeah. But we're certainly covering it still and keeping abreast of what's going on. Lisa Wharf, education reporter.
Yes, indeed. That's me.
And Lisa covers education.
Yes, she covers education, and she's had her first experience of trying to get permits from the city this week.
The county. Yes. It took 4 days, 5 days, and I got a permit so I can install a washer dryer hookup finally. And
it hasn't always been a pleasant experience navigating the bureaucracy.
I've been pushing.
No, I have to say the county has been very quick in their response. It's just there were different responses several times. So finally, we got it figured out yesterday from a helpful employee.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
I've said she ought to do a story about it. I'd love to hear an in-depth first-person account of trying to install a washer dryer and needing building permits for it.
Yeah, and I actually had that thought before I started the process. I thought it could be a long, difficult one, and I didn't record myself, but I thought about that. Yeah. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, Patrick Cannon, he's heading to prison. We knew that, but we know for how long now, 44 mm-hmm. months, assuming he served all of that,
which he won't. Back in June when Cannon pleaded guilty, he signed a plea agreement with federal prosecutors, and they had agreed to ask for no more than 5 to 6 years. And in reality, in court, they asked the judge for far less than that. I think they asked him for between 3 and 4 years, but closer to the 3 side. And the judge actually went
37 months.
That's right, 37 months. And thank you. And the judge went further than that and gave him a harsher sentence than prosecutors asked for. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting for a couple of reasons. It shows, first of all, that we can get some hints of, we know there's an ongoing investigation happening, mm-hmm. and we can get some hints of that prosecutors found Cannon helpful. He agreed in the plea agreement, it was, all right, they're only going to ask for this certain amount, because the maximum sentence for the charge he's facing for this type of public corruption, it was 20 years, mm-hmm. and a $250,000 fine. And instead, he got fined $50,000 and 44 months in prison. So
$10,000, and then he has the restitution of
$50,000. Right, exactly. Yeah. Thanks. I mean, it's far less than, you know, Ray Nagin, for instance, in New Orleans got. Nagin had got 10 years. Now, granted, he went to trial and, mm-hmm. and pleaded not guilty and those kind of things. And he was facing somewhere between 14 and 20 counts of, off the top of my head, I don't remember, but somewhere between 14 and 20 counts of different forms of bribery and fraud and money laundering and so forth. And then Rod Blagojevich, the former mayor of Chicago. Governor of Illinois. God. I'm not on it today. Governor of Illinois. He was given 14 years. Mm-hmm. Same thing, though. He pleaded not guilty and so forth. So I think, you know, we see partially just, you know, how effective those plea agreements are in those kind of cases, how Cannon has tried to become an asset. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, you know, one of the things that Tom Bullock, who was out in the courtroom, reported on was prosecutors mentioned this one provision in the sentencing law, and they said, you know, that basically lets them ask for more leniency based on how helpful the information he's given them has been. And they said that they couldn't do that because while he'd been really helpful, the information he'd given was really not that useful. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because, you know, we know that the investigation's been ongoing. We've been kind of waiting for another shoe to drop. We've been waiting for to see who else is going to get caught up in this thing, whether it's, you know, political figures or whether it's city staff or whether it's people in the business community. We already know from earlier documents that came out around the time of the plea agreement that there's a strip club owner who's, you know, since been identified as David Slim Bockham. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, accused of giving bribes to Cannon over a period of time. But he hasn't faced any charges. So, you know, we know that there's been some other things out there that the FBI has found that they've that they're saying happened. And yet at the same time, they've said that Cannon did not provide useful information, mm-hmm. Substantially useful information in terms of any other investigations that are going on.
Well, we were waiting for the other shoe to drop. But I mean, the things that have come out to this point haven't been real earth-shaking things,
no.
You know, have not been big things at all. So, you know, it seems to indicate that maybe there's not going to be too much more coming out.
You know, we've known that there's this ongoing investigation. You know, after for Cannon, it was a 4-year FBI sting operation. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of resources being put into this thing, and I think there's been a sense that there's, you know, some big, you know, network of corruption. The idea that there's this big investigation going on, it's, you know, ongoing, that there was a, you know, 4 or 5 year thing happening. It's still going. They've mm-hmm. already got Cannon. They got the mayor, but it's still going on. And yet, you know, the mayor can't provide any information, even to the best of his abilities, to help them find any more people. So, yeah, maybe there isn't that much. Maybe it's overblown.
Yeah. And he just was trying to make it sound like he had more influence than he did.
Right. Well, that's the other part of it that's kind of funny, is that there's, you know, I was on Charlotte Talks on Tuesday before the sentencing, and Mike Collins asked me that. He asked, you know, is there any, do we have any evidence that Cannon actually did anything? We know he took money, but do we know if he actually gave any influence? And, you know, we have evidence that he tried.
Mm-hmm.
He made phone calls mm-hmm. for people and, you know, connected them to city staff and said, you know, hey, help this guy out, will you? Those things wouldn't necessarily have been illegal, except for the fact they took money for it,
right.
Because it's your job mm-hmm. as a city councilman to connect people,
right?
Yeah, to the constituent services. It's like that's part of the job.
Sure.
So, and of course, you know, he doesn't have specific influence to tell people what to do. So there isn't really mm-hmm. a lot of evidence that he necessarily affected any change, you know, for people who paid him money to do that, which is kind of funny.
Well, there are three things on Dave's sentencing that kind of stood out to me. One, I found it shocking that he actually shows up to court 15 minutes late.
Yeah.
Judge wasn't happy with that.
Right, yeah, and they said that they got the time wrong from reading the papers.
Which is just ridiculous excuse. and by the way, everything I saw in media was said 9 o'clock too, so I never saw a different time. I thought it was interesting that he asked for a delay in his sentencing because of birthdays, anniversaries, and Christmas coming up. I mean, it's, you're doing prison, man. I mean, you can't, everyone has those things. What makes you special?
Yeah, I mean, I think
I guess it doesn't hurt to ask, but
yeah, I mean, I found it
comical.
yeah. I mean, you know, I guess he's going to jail.
That's the one of the bad things about going to prison. You miss that family time and all those things that are important to you in your regular life.
Right.
And that you asked to get a. To have a delay so that you don't have to, so you can put that off. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I understand that to some degree. You know, you want to get like one last time with these people before you're going to be gone for a very long time. So, that makes sense to me.
mm-hmm. Yeah. It did make me wonder, is there anyone who doesn't ask for leniency who goes and says, I feel pretty bad. I deserve something.
Yeah.
Who plays it stoic?
I
wonder what the result would be on that.
I don't know how often
I'll take
those,
my punishment.
I should say I don't know how often those pleas for delay in sentencing because of a birthday or an anniversary, some special family event comes up. I don't know how often those are granted, but if it was I certainly I'm assuming it's very rare that those those are granted. Granted,
right,
I don't know for sure.
I don't know. I mean, you know, Cannon had very, very good counsel. You know, had very good lawyers. So I'm sure he walked through with them what he was going to ask and what he wanted and those kind of things before making that request. Doesn't mean that they thought he'd have a good shot at it.
Right.
But, yeah.
Doesn't hurt to ask, I guess. But and then the judge, you were just talking a little bit before we started this, he said he told Mr. Cannon that, I know you're a good man.
Yeah. Yeah,
just I thought.
Well, that struck us as odd. I think partially because we're reporters, mm-hmm. and so like we would never, I think, make that judgment of somebody one way or the other, right? We would never. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the question it puzzled us how Lisa and I were. It puzzled us how the judge, like, just I mean, where that kind of came from, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, how does he know?
Right. And
I mean, he had a lot of people trying to vouch for his character on his behalf. I think is. Was it Sunday school teacher?
Yeah, they put in a lot of people. There were there were letters written. They had everything from a retired former Panther player, mm-hmm. to Sunday school teacher and other teachers from back when he was growing up, friends and public officials had written in from and so forth. So. They had all of that. And so I think that, and that was their goal, was to make the case that this was a good man who had made a mistake. That was the defense's case. That's what they're trying to prove. Because the judge has the discretion to, has wide discretion on mm-hmm. what that sentence is going to be. It doesn't really, the prosecutors, what they recommend is one part of it, but, a big part of it, that's one part the judge considers, but ultimately it's the judge making mm-hmm. the decision.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to the next topic. Lisa, the story that caught your attention this week was something in the ProPublica, first reported by ProPublica, was about a guy who makes a lot of money running charter schools, and he has some charter schools in North Carolina. Of course, we've heard about some schools around here that went out of business very, very soon, but... or had to be shut down.
Sure, and actually Michael Tomczyk brought that one to my attention. But, it's something that Baker Mitchell is the man's name, and he runs a company called Roger Bacon Academy. And basically, they are a for-profit company, one of these companies that charter schools bring in to do the daily operations of the school. And he's been on the radar of a lot of folks around here. His schools are out east. And the thing that is really sort of intriguing in this situation, for a long time, he owns the company, but he was on the board of schools that would select the company as the vendor who ran the school.
So he owned the company that ran the school?
He owned the company that ran the school, and Roger Bacon Academy.
And then he owned the companies that they bought all their supplies from and everything.
Yeah, I mean, they provided a lot of, I mean, for example, his company leases land property to the schools and desks and things like that, as well as runs the schools. But he was until recently also on the boards of these schools that would select the companies and the vendors to come in.
That is a great.
Obviously, there's a
you have the public money.
There's a conflict of interest.
Yes,
and the article was really interesting. Is written by Marian Wang, and it kind of looks. It's a big picture look at how this all happens and comes together, and how it kind of coincides with some of the changes in state laws. So, the IRS saw this as a conflict of interest mm-hmm. back several years ago, and actually came to them and said, "We're taking away your nonprofit status because this is a conflict of interest you shouldn't have." And so they switched around a few things, and they finally came to an agreement where the IRS allowed them to keep the nonprofit status and keep the vendors and whatever, but
it's still the same result, right?
He's still on the board that chooses the company.
It's still
that's
the same
his
result.
Company. Yeah.
Now he has, state. The state has kind of charter school folks have kind of pushed him, pressured him to leave those boards. Mm-hmm. So he is no longer on the board of the schools.
But he's still making the money.
He's still
off of running charter schools and he's still be able to provide get. Those charter schools that his company runs they're still ordering supplies from his own company.
Well, what's interesting though
is that correct?
For example, like he's not on the board But he is the secretary of the board at one school, at least. So he's at all the board meetings. He's taking the notes and everything else. And he had a new charter school, and it almost didn't get approved. There was some pressure that the advisory board, which makes all these recommendations to the state board to approve charters, they re-review applications, and that was one of them. And they re-reviewed it, and one of the things they said is that because two people from that company were on the charter school board, they said, okay, this can go through, but they have to get off the board. So
how many charter schools does this company run in North Carolina? Four. Okay.
Four charter schools. And it's hard to say how much profit the company makes from this because they're a private company and they don't have to, you know, submit those numbers. And, you know, there's the question is, you know, if a company is doing a good job at running a school, the kids are doing well, well, what does it matter, you know, if they profit or not or how much profit they make? The question, though, is, you know, how much better are those students doing than if they were at another school? Mm-hmm. And the article kind of goes into this, that it's hard to figure that out because, one, in several of the schools, they don't have as many what's called disadvantaged kids, you know, low-income kids at that school than what the regular school
district.
Same
argument you hear about in other public schools. Too.
Sure, yeah. Sure. And one of them does have a lot of low-income schools, mm-hmm. one of the newer ones.
Low-income students.
Yes, low-income students.
Should be noted that a lot of charter school advocates have a big problem with this.
They do have a big problem with the conflict of interest mm-hmm. that comes about when the for-profit management company is on the board and is selecting their own for-profit management company. And so a lot of states have rules and laws against this. And North Carolina is not one of them that does. I mean, you know, there's pressure for that not to happen. But there's nothing explicit in law that says that can't happen.
That it can't happen, yeah.
We'll have more on this story from the woman who wrote the article, Marion Wang, for ProPublica. Marshall Terry is going to be talking to her on Morning Edition on Monday.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Ben, you were in court recently, and not for yourself, but covering something. And Charlotte's airport, looks like the city can retain control of it for now. But is it going to stay that way?
For now, yeah. Both sides declared victory. Really, the decision gives the victory to the city. But it is the thing to understand is that the issue is very big. The issue is who gets to control Charlotte Douglas Airport. Will it be the city, like they've done for the last almost 80 years, or will it be this commission created by state lawmakers?
And for now, it's the city.
For now, it's the city. But the court decision was not about that issue. The court decision was, did lawmakers who created this commission screw up on this kind of small point? I mean, it's a big point. It's a point that has a big effect. But it's sort of a narrow point, which is that they didn't ask the Federal Aviation Administration for permission to do this. They didn't get the certificate of operation that says, hey, this commission can run an airport, which is, you know, which the FAA controls. And so the judge agreed with the city that the state didn't do that. They which means that the commission can't run it because they don't have the certificate. But all it would take is the FAA handing it to them. And then the state would be in control. The thing is that the FAA has said they won't do that unless the city asks them to.
Oh, well, I'm sure that's not the end of that story.
Unfortunately, I think we're going to see a lot more of this.
Okay. All right. Ben, Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.